Welcome to this podcast based on the international conference at the cutting edges of knowledge production that was held in Bielefeld in October and November 2021. In this episode, we will discuss the challenges of the Anthropocene from the perspective of the humanities and social sciences. The following debate is moderated by Professor Dr. Angelika Appler, historian and Vice Rector for International Relations and Research at University of Bielefeld. Theorizing on the relationship between nature and humankind amidst the Anthropocene era might feel like a drop in the ocean on a planet that is running out of time to preserve its own existence. Theory will not cut off this crisis, but it's a step in the right direction that certainly adds up to other small efforts towards preventing the ultimate clash of planet Earth. Climate scientists' desperate claim to save us from our own action need to be placed in the thick of things before we reach a point of no return.
Today, it is largely undisputed that the concept of the Anthropocene as a new epoch in the history of Earth results from a profound ecological diagnosis. By now, the impact of the human species has been so deep that its consequences ultimately call for an understanding of the human being as geological force. Part of this global, or maybe more correct, planetary crisis are phenomena like climate change, today perceived as the most urgent global crisis topic, economic extractivism, habitat destruction, etc., etc. In all these cases, ecological problems are evolving into crisis patterns that are targeting global self-preservation not only of the human species, but of Earth as rhizomatic structure of interactions and interdependencies. And with this consideration of nature as a medium of crisis, the question emerges which understanding of nature would be appropriate to approach such challenges, and how non-human entities or non-human actors were to be considered within processes of mitigation, adaptation, or even prevention. What is also becoming evident is the fact that long before the notion of the Anthropocene emerged as a substantial concept, the human species did establish as geological force. Thus, the Anthropocene does not constitute the human being as geological force. Only in the Anthropocene, this fact has become undeniable. In fact, the Anthropocene is only the result of previous processes in history which have been culminating in the second half of the 20th century and in early 21st century. Which nature it is with which the world is confronted in the Anthropocene? If the assumption of a pristine nature is seen as an illusion, as nature is always a concept that derives from cultural assumptions and relations, this kind of first nature functions as fictional ideal of a world that is characterized by the absence of human action. Philosophical anthropology has invented the notion of a second nature that aims at the artificial environment that humans do create and that also constitutes the realm of culture in which humans live. Culture itself is, in this sense, regarded as second nature, as it provides the essential environment in which human life is only possible. The modern state of a domination of nature was following the logic of colonialist power. Nature, as second nature, is a colonized entity. A third nature is turned to an abject and monstrous nature when, at the peak of modern industrialized societies, a segment of techno-associated nature separates from such domination of nature by merging with anthropogenic technology. This said, the domination of nature through industrialization and technology and its effect on the production of techno-wise informed nature results in a paradoxical situation. Because in the effect, it is exactly this sort of a technologically modified and associated nature that turns into an element of sustainable disruption, maybe even destruction of such association. It is especially the paradigmatic phenomena of the Anthropocene, like climate change, that cannot be understood as natural nature, but as products of technologically affected forms of nature that can only emerge under the condition of a complete association and technification of nature. In this sense, third nature transforms into a thought of anthropomorphic nature that takes monstrous shape. As such, it separates from an anthropogenic second nature produced by association and culturalization. To this background, it still seems to be fruitful to follow Pro-Rabino and imply an anthropology of reason that reflects on the precondition of human life, culture, and society, from which then also derives the non-human as other or derivative.
I would like to hand over to Professor Dr. Charlotte Rickley Asante. And she is an associate professor in the Department of Geography and Resource Development at the University of Ghana. At Ghana University, she also officiates as a co-director of the Maria Sibylla Merian Institute for Advanced Studies in Africa. So again, a very warm welcome to you. Her main research interests include gender, urbanization, climate change, and empowerment issues in Ghana. In this field, she explores the causal nexuses between crime and poverty and the gender dynamics of crime and safety in urban public spaces. Moreover, Charlotte Rickley Asante studies gendered livelihoods and informal cross-border traders. Recently, she has also been engaging with the gendered implications of climate change, leading a case study on Ghanaian smallholder agricultural farmers, where she also explored the gender differences in their adaptation strategies.
And so I'm going to just give a broad overview of the situation of climate change in Africa and then Ghana specifically, and then use some of the works, my own work and what others have done to share the experiences of smallholder farmers when it comes to climate change issues. And so as a way of introduction, I think the previous speaker has talked a lot about some of these things, that globally there is evidence. He mentioned climatologists and others, you know, the scientists have shown and are still predicting that climate change is impacting on the ecological, social, and economic systems of the planet Earth that we live on. So in Ghana, just a brief background, at least some of you may know, others may not really know where Ghana is located. Ghana is in West Africa, is located within these latitudes and longitudes, and is a tropical country, you know, and strongly influenced by the West African trade winds. And so the intertropical convergence zones, controls the rainfall patterns. So we have traditionally have two major rainfall patterns depending on the ITCZ, the position of the ITCZ. And so there's a major rainy season and then a minor rainy season. Traditionally, the ordinary farmer, the rural farmer, they have studied these patterns over the year and they are aware of these patterns. When it rains or when it's expected to rain and the dry season and all of that. The Anthropocene is shaped by humans. But human beings, they have also responded and they are responding and adapting to these new challenges and these new and environmental challenges. And Anthropocene in Africa has experienced processes of adaptation and the introduction of new crops, because people must survive. People have to sustain themselves. because they depend on these things, the farmers depend on these directly for their sustenance. And so they are also finding, even though the argument is that they are contributing to all of these climatic changes, human beings themselves, the smallholder farmer, is also contributing or trying to sustain itself and trying to be resilient to all of these challenges.
We are going to hear a third paper given by Professor Dr. Christoph Mauch. And I'm happy to welcome you. Christoph Mauch is chair in American Culture and Transatlantic Relations at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich, where he also serves as affiliated professor in the Faculty of History. Furthermore, and I didn't know that, he is an honorary professor at Renmin University in China, and he officiates as co-director of the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society. Originally, Christoph Mauch engaged with the history of the United States and the study of transatlantic relations. Afterwards, he expanded his research area towards environmental history and subsequently towards global environmental history.
Well, environmental historians today, I think it's obvious to all of us that environmental history is powerful and can explain a lot. In Germany, we just saw that hundreds of people died as a result of the flood. So nature can be an actor. The wildfires that we saw in Turkey looked like the ones in Australia. Loire Valley 2 years ago looked like the Sahara. So nature as an actor is something that was brought into our minds. That's one thing. But at the same time, environmental historians have very much pointed out that our perception matters, our perception of nature, what we do with nature. Let's say in Canada, the oil sands, whether we leave them in the sand or whether we take the oil out makes a big difference. For once, I think it's important to realize that we live on one Earth that is distinct. It's a globe that cannot be cut off into compartments. I think historians, I know it's difficult, I don't quite know how to do it, but I think historians have to take into account the more than human world. We have to realize that the Earth and all its creatures are co-constituting us, have constituted us in history, will co-constitute us in the future. We can't live without them. We are totally entangled. We are entangled on the globe, globally. We're also entangled with the creatures around us that have given us the current pandemic and will give us many more in the future. It's important to look at how technology is determining us and is taking away our liberties and is taking away our future, if you will. And it's also important to look at how our livelihoods are destroyed, as Charlotte has shown us. But I think if we understand that we are all earthlings, it could be a step in a positive direction.
Really do not have to introduce Deepesh Chakrabarti to you, but there might be some details that you're not aware of. For instance, that he is Lawrence A. Kimpton, Distinguished Service Professor of History, and I love that description of his chair in South Asian Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago. So there are denominations that also point to interdisciplinarity. Here you hear history, languages, and civilizations. In addition, he currently officiates as a faculty director of the university's center in Delhi. Of course, is Deepesh Chakrabarti familiar to you? And he's best known for his reflections on human sciences very broadly. His thoughts on post-colonialism and on the study of the subalterns already have been inviting scholars to decentralize and rethink the worldviews of over 20 years.
What is life? So a biological question, which was already amenable to thermodynamic thinking, was coming up out of these researches, from which comes the science of global warming and this idea that, as Christoph was saying, that we simply don't act on this planet. Our actions produce further actions on the part of the planet, in its time, in the different planetary processes. And so I would say that on the one hand, in the world, there was stories growing that had to do with democratization of social science and humanities, which were fundamentally predicated on a suspicion of all claims of universality or all claims of one world. Whereas the scientific investigations, beginning with atmospheric sciences into space sciences, then the question of global warming was creating a world, one world narrative. And the agency which we had created after the war, United Nations, which by the way initially was actually thought about as a substitute of the League of Nations, and one person very interested, as you know, instrumental in creating the Charter of the United Nations was Jan Smuts from South Africa, who believed in white supremacy, and who thought that with the decline of Britain, the world order had to be changed, and the Americans and the Soviets had to be brought in charge of a world which would still be based on white supremacy, so that the job of colonizing the natives in Africa and elsewhere could go on. Geographical distribution has been somewhat complicated, but what happened? What is also happening? What also has complicated this question is the question of the non-human, which initially looked like question of the big non-humans, like the climate system of the planet, or the deep oceanic currents, or the role of the glaciers, or the role of the Amazon forests, which is huge in terms of its area, or the role of the Siberian permafrost, or the role of the polar regions and the polar ice cap. But it was also becoming clear, as they asked this question, the scientists, what is life? And why does life persist? And this is a contribution that has come from the sciences. No human culture before the sciences could have actually dreamt this up. Is the fact, but the point that we know now, that the majority forms of life on this planet are microbial. And microbial and very small forms of life, like bacteria, viruses, protists, like fungi, phytoplanktons, they play the most critical role in maintaining the basis for life's continuity on the planet.
I would like to introduce him to the audience. Franz Maulshagen is Associate Professor in History at Bielefeld University, Affiliate Scholar at the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies, and associate member of the Vienna Anthropocene Network. His main research include environmental history, climate history, the history of disasters, and the history of the early modern period.
The concept that failed with the post-Kyoto process and was overcome as the lock-in that blocked everything, I think, was the budgetary approach. But let me just remind everybody what the budgetary approach was between states. It's the idea mostly figured out by scientists, by climate scientists, by earth system scientists. How many reductions each state would have to commit to in order to reach the 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, depending on what was to be negotiated in the respective frameworks, the targets, and of course, degrees Celsius are calculated in how much CO2 or carbon emissions have to be reduced, so and so many gigatons of carbon. And of course, this is an unequal world. Deepesh has already pointed to the problem of inequality, and the inequality is particularly significant between states if we look at per capita emissions, which are hugely different even today between some of the greatest per capita emitters in the West, to which belong the United States. Per capita emissions, for example, in Australia are even higher, but the number of people is much lower than in the United States. And if you compare that with China, which is the greatest absolute emitter, but still by far not the greatest per capita emitter. So per capita emissions have been something of a standard of measuring inequality in terms of contributions to emissions. And of course, the question of justice was connected with the budgetary approach, as well as historical recognition of responsibilities of early industrial states. there was no planetary representation anymore in the politics. And I think this is a powerful illustration of what the category of the planetary illustrates, what the category of the planetary does to discourse here. I think it's a particular moment in time where that argument worked. And it's a sign actually of the future for me of what happened in 2016 and the following years, where in many ways, particularly on the conservative right in many Western democratic countries, this argument has been strengthened from various points of views. So that's, I think, also finally a sign of the transition we've made from the global to the planetary, although we still have not found the clue of how a world that has been split into many demoses, many people who are organized in the states and other kinds of political units will make a transition to actually responding to this non-human entity that is the Earth or the climate system. One of the explanations, one of the approaches of explaining why a group of people thinking about climate change, like Dipesh Chakrabarty, like Bruno Latour, like other people, including myself, have felt this discomfort with categories such as the global or world.
Institutions of knowledge production, as well as NGOs, civil society organizations, and state agencies, are presented with the task of coping with the multiple crises of the Anthropocene. And, as we have heard today, this is also a task for every person living on this planet. We hope you feel inspired. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of At the Cutting Edges of Knowledge Production.